morning, Mr. Metzger. The place you are looking at is a bunker located in north central Indiana. It is right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern. Also nearby and out back is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard. Your mission, Tom, should you decide to accept it, is to enter the bunker and broadcast an internet radio show on the Insurgent Radio Network. While broadcasting, you are to supply information to the listeners on the big website, resist.com. As always, should you or any of your insurgency force be caught or killed, Echo will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Right, oh, and we are at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And this is the 2nd of April, fourth month, second day, Wotan's Day. And I hope you didn't get April fooled yesterday. I luckily escaped this year. Usually I get April fooled quite a bit, but this year I escaped. Well, my kids surprised me this year and dropped me off, sent me a new computer. How about that? The only problem is that once you get a new computer, you got to figure a whole lot of things out. I'm used to running on old computers around here. So I was going to do the show on the new computer today, but I got so screwed up, I had to go back to the old computer until my webmaster helps me out and gets us straight to where I know what I'm doing. Fussed around for half the morning here, man. Half the morning's over. I'm finally getting the show going. Stray Dog was not able to be with us this morning. We were supposed to be together yesterday and do a show, but I missed that, so and he couldn't make it today, so we'll just have to figure another time. Boy, that old rogue progressive guy, man, he's really going after that Adelson out there in Las Vegas. And I don't hear any of these conservative radio stations. Of course, I don't really listen to them that much. They're pretty boring. I haven't heard them talking about the big suck-up confab in Vegas with all these so-called conservatives that may be running for president one of these days. Going out there and genuflecting to let Kike Adelson out there in Las Vegas. Listen to this.
I have to say about this because this whole topic just literally, I said this earlier, it makes me nauseous to try to imagine these so-called Christian white American governors prostrating themselves and begging and scraping and slobbering all over themselves in front of this this Zionist in Las Vegas who makes money by cheating people out of their, in some instances, hard-earned money. It's just disgusting. And Adelson knows, since the Citizens United ruling, that he can spend $100,000,000,000. He can spend $1 billion if he wants to. It doesn't make any difference. He's going to buy himself a president. Now, back to Christie, who apologized on Saturday, like I reported to you, for using the term occupied territories at this event of the slime, the so-called, what's it called, the Republican Jewish Coalition. Oh, please. Andy Aboud, the senior vice president of Adelson's Las Vegas Sands Corporation, told CNN that Christie later apologized specifically to Adelson for using that terrible, truthful term. That Christie sucked up to Adelson yet again, this time in a private meeting. Can you imagine? Imagine Christie walking in all sweaty and slobbery in front of this guy. Mr. Adelson, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to tell the truth. I'm sorry. According to Adelson Senior Vice President, Christie said, Mr. Adelson, I misspoke. And I don't believe that it's occupied territories. Now, Politico offered similar details on the meeting. This is what Politico said. A source told them that Christie, quote, clarified in the strongest terms possible that his remarks were not meant to be a statement of policy. Instead, the source said, Christie made clear to this corpse-looking Adelson, quote, that he misspoke when he referred to the occupied territories. And he conveyed that he is an unwavering friend and committed supporter of Israel and was sorry for any confusion that came across as a result of the misstatement. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? Well, you better believe it, because that's what's happened to your American political system. Sheldon Adelson said he was satisfied with Christie's apology. I'm satisfied. All right. Now get out of here. What are you talking about? Occupied territories, really? Occupied by whom? Christie said, what got him in so much trouble? I took a helicopter ride from the occupied territories across and just felt personally how extraordinary that was to understand the military risk that Israel faces every day. Military risk? From people in Gaza who live in one of the poorest patches of sand and filth on earth? Military threat? What? Israel with 200, 500, 800 nuclear bombs, and Christie, this lying, hypocritical son of a bitch, stands up there and says that he acknowledges the military risk that Israel is under every day? What? And this is your guy, Christie, who... it was touted by everybody in media, everybody from Tweety Bird on MSNBC. Oh, this is a Republican I can do business with. Really? Shake hands with the devil, Chris Matthews. I mean, you're going to do business with this slime bastard? Wow. This is your political system, Truth Seeker. This is what's become of it. How does it feel? You know how it feels to me? It feels like hell. Feels like hell. Oh, and speaking of white male Christians making fools of themselves in front of a Jewish gambling magnate or making fools of themselves on about Judaism on television. Pat Robertson opens his mouth and jams both his feet in again. Hear about this? This is according to Gawker.com. This is how Robertson explains the Jews. he asked on his program, his television program the other night, what is it about Jewish people that make them prosper financially? And then he answered his own question. Jews don't fix their cars or mow their lawns, which leaves them more time for their primary occupation, polishing diamonds. Jesus Christ. On his program, this another hovering near death, almost corpse-like human being, Pat Robertson, you ought to get together with Adelson. They're both billionaires. And he was talking with Daniel Lappin, a rabbi and author of books on the intersection of business and religion. That's a nice topic. And Robertson managed to turn a conversation that was sort of about economic specialization and yada, yada, yada. He turned it all into a joke about every Jewish person's main gig being polishing diamonds and counting riches, huh? Haven't heard that one pretty much constantly, or have heard that one pretty much constantly since around, what, 500 A.D.? But there's Pat Robertson. Well, that's why they don't mow their lawns or work under their cars. They're polishing diamonds. Wow. Now, you might ask, how is Robertson expert on diamonds? Well, if you wipe the blood off of them, he's a pretty good expert. He used funds from his Rwandan refugee charity, so-called Operation Blessing, to transport diamond mining equipment for a joint venture he had with Zaire's dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko, in the 1990s. Yeah, this great Christian. He gets all these contributions. He rents a plane to take, we're going to take food and clothing to the poor little black Rwandans. No, you're not, you lying, hypocritical. Pat Robertson, enjoy your life, because there's an abyss waiting for you, man, when you step off this mortal coil. There really is. The diamond mining scandal was the subject of a 2013 documentary, Mission Congo. And Robertson, of course, lied through his ass because he is a televangelist. He denied allegations that the charity, the Operation Blessing, was merely a front. In a 1999 report by the U.S. Attorney General's office found that Robertson was misleading when he collected the donations, but that he wasn't guilty of fraud. No, he wasn't. And Dick Cheney and George W. Bush are not guilty of war crimes either. These disgusting people. This is what capitalism has produced. And yes, it has to do with capitalism. You have Republican wannabes for the presidential nomination of their stinking party just slobbering and prostrating themselves and turning themselves into 10-cent whores, no offense to real sex workers, and just bowing and scraping before this stiletto-heeled, pimp-hatted Sheldon Adelson. How can we have some of your money, Shelley? Thanks for inviting me. And Adelson sitting there burping and farting and saying, what did you say? Did you say something about occupied territories? What are you talking about? Ooh, I'm sorry, Mr. Adelson. I misspoke. I didn't mean any of that. I am so sorry. Please forgive me. See, I can't get away from it. I can't get away from it. It's just horrifying. It's horrifying. Horrifying. I don't think there's ever been anything like this in the American political system since the very beginning. I really don't. I'm not talking about the offshoots of the American. I'm talking about the core of the American political system. It is now nothing but a huge stinking sewer. We'll be right back.
You know, this is why the internet is so good. Because you have to go a lot of different places to get the jewels of the news and commentary. And you don't have to depend on these whore networks. And you can listen to the left, listen to the right, listen to the progressives, listen to the conservative. You can listen to them all and pick out the good stuff. Adelson couldn't be described any better. You know, just think of the billions of dollars that people, a good share of which are white, have poured into his, garbage bin, I guess you'd call it. And these conservatives that these people are getting ready to support out here in the Midwest, all these Republicans, they're going to support these guys as they go on their knees begging to do fellatio with the fat little Jew in Las Vegas. Oh, man. You got to have wings to stay above this shit. Well, we got some information here on the Croatian thing. Not the Croatian thing, the Ukrainian thing. If I can get it out of here. 1. Crimea is far more defensible than an operation in eastern Ukraine. 2. Kiev now has to worry about a two-front assault if there's ever a conflict from Crimea from the east, any belligerents like the Georgia operation, and a whole chunk of the Ukraine would be lost. 3. Crimea just escaped austerity that will not be lost on Eastern Ukrainian workers who will probably launch a people's color revolution of their own making as a response to the cuts that will have plausible deniability by Moscow, who would only have to express moral sympathy and behind-the-scenes orchestration. 4. Russia will probably succeed in pushing Ukraine towards a more federal, decentralized system where they will exert soft power due to ethnic ties. Soft power doesn't need the stigma of military occupation. Group in Kiev will have less and less authority in eastern Ukraine as they squabble amongst each other for power in the fiefdom of the city of Kiev. Russia's main interest is to probably create such a questionable situation in the Ukraine that big money powers won't risk a lot of money on a bad investment. I think that's what Crimea showed them. After Crimea, they will probably sue for a status of quo ante bellum. 5. Russia probably doesn't want to rock the boat too much as they took the Europeans up to a verge of agreeing to real sanctions, but no further. More than 6,000 German companies do business in Russia, and the more integrated they get, the more impossible it will be to ever get Germany to go along with any action against Russia. 6. Russia is still trying to diversify their economy and trading partners in the East. In 5 to 10 years, sanctions won't even have the ability to use as an accusation. Anyhow, that's some interesting stuff coming out of the Eastern European theater. It's about as far as I want to get into that stuff anyhow, because we've got all these other super experts on the internet. It's unbelievable how many of these quasi-right-wingers are off into every nook and cranny of everything happening from Spain to Outer Mongolia, man. They're experts at everything, so I'll leave most of that to them. Well, these LGBT people sure are flexing their muscles. LGBT advocates in the tech industry and all over the world are in shock over Mozilla's decision to name co-founder Brendan Eich as the company's new CEO. Oh my God, a co-founder being made CEO? Per a Los Angeles Times report released in 2012, Ike made a $1,000 donation to the Yes on 8 campaign, which supported California's ban on same-gender marriages, Proposition 8. Oh, the horror of it all. Ike released a statement via his personal blog to address the controversy. Now let's see how he gets out of this. Quote, I know there are concerns about my commitment to fostering equality and welcome for LGBT individuals at Mozilla. We would never turn one away. I can only ask for your support to have time to show, not tell, and in the meantime express my sorrow at having caused pain. Could you imagine if this, if he'd have made a contribution to Tom Metzger's congressional race or some white research outfit? I am committed to ensuring that Mozilla is and will remain a place that includes and supports everyone. Would you support me, sir? Regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, age, race, ethnicity, economic status, religion. There's probably some more, but I forgot them. A spokesman for Mozilla, a nonprofit and creator of Firefox web browser, also released a statement saying the company was deeply committed to honoring diversity in sexual orientation and beliefs within our staffs and community. With thousands of people spanning many countries and cultures, diversity is the core to who we are. We're united in our mission to keep the web open and accessible to everyone. In her own personal blog, Christy Kaler, who is Mozilla's education lead and part of the LGBT group, supported Mozilla's decision, though she did express disappointment in Eichmann's donation to Proposition 8. He shouldn't have political freedom. He shouldn't have the right to vote for that. No, you can't do that. Certainly it would be problematic if Brendan's behavior with Mozilla was explicitly discriminatory. I haven't personally seen this, although to be clear, I was not a part of Brendan's reporting structure until today, she wrote. To the contrary, over the years I've watched Brendan be an ally in many areas and bring clarity and leadership when it was needed. But not all Mozilla's employees have been as understanding as Ike. Via a simultaneous tweet, multiple employees sent united messages telling the newly appointed CEO to step down. How dare you be a heterosexual and a committed heterosexual? We can have none of that. Chris McBoy led the pack as he swished through the office. I love at Mozilla, but I am disappointed this week. A Mozilla stands for openness and empowerment, but is acting in the opposite way. He then declared, I'm an employee of A Mozilla, and I'm asking A Brendanish to step down as CEO, unquote. Almost immediately, employees including John Bevan, Jessica Klein, Sidney Moyer, and Chloe Verdelli tweaked very similar sentiments and also asked the CEO to resign. Well, I think they should hang the son of a bitch. Let's not go part way with this stuff. Let's just start hanging anybody that's not pro-queer and pro-this and pro-weird and pro-not-can't-marry-your-dog or something like that. Let's get them out of the way, man. Boy, oh boy, Congressman Ryan, he's really stepped in at this time. As debate continued over the controversial remarks of Representative Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, Fox News host Bill O'Reilly antagonized one Ryan opponent, calling her a race hustler. That's an interesting term. Ryan made this controversial remarks on Bill Bennett's Morning in America radio show last week when he answered a question regarding the fatherless problem in poor, interpret that, nigger neighborhoods. Ryan said, we have got this tailspin of culture, that's not culture, in our inner cities and in particular of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work, unquote. Well, fellow U.S. Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, who is black as the ace of spades, rebutted, quote, my colleague Congressman Ryan's comments about the inner city poverty are thinly veiled racial attack and cannot be tolerated. We know that all black men work all the time. They work hard. Let's be clear. When Mr. Ryan says inner city, when he says culture, these are simply code words for what he really means is black. Well, no, he really means the niggas. Those niggas won't work. Instead of demonizing culture and blaming nigger men for their poverty, well, who else would you blame? Mr. Ryan should step up and produce some legitimate proposals on how to tackle poverty, like raising money and giving it to them. And racial discrimination in America, his uniformed policy proposals continue to increase poverty, not to solve it, unquote. I love it when these white conservatives try to hold their tongue. They're too damn big a coward to just say, why don't you just shut up, your black ass nigga mouth, babe? Wouldn't that be a breath of fresh air? Ryan maintained that he was referring to poor communities. not black men specifically. See, they're such hypocrites. These goddamn Republicans, you know what he means. The nigger knows what he means. Everybody knows what he means. But he still tries to back out of it. Appearing on the O'Reilly Factor, Ryan asserted his stance during his interview, saying, Lee is a longtime colleague, and he harbors no bad feelings toward her. In fact, he asked her for a date one time, and she refused. He also said he understands that if you challenge the status quo, sometimes you'll be misinterpreted. Now the status quo is Negro. O'Reilly, on the other hand, did not agree with Ryan's outlook, calling Lee a race hustler, and suggested they get voted into office by portraying their constituents as victims. Quote, it's all your fault, it's my fault, and it's rich people's fault, and the Republicans' fault. It's everybody's fault, except what's going on. The race hustlers don't want to solve the problem. Shortly after, Lee released the following statement in response to O'Reilly's attack. Unfortunately, we've come to expect language like welfare queens, food stamp president, and now race hustlers from the right wing and Mr. O'Reilly. It is disgusting and divisive and should never be accepted in our national discourse. For us to achieve the American dream for all, we must engage in a conversation that has been sparked about race and poverty. Even if it's difficult for some, the racial discrimination, poverty, and income inequality remains issues that must be debated and addressed. And these kind of code words only get in the way of solving the real problem, which is the white race. If we could just get the white race out of the way, niggers would automatically be rich. For a while, until the Jews came along. As members of Congress, we must come together and present a budget and funding priorities. Always funding priorities, yeah. That create opportunity for all. Yeah. We must make critical investments in job creation, education, job training, among many issues, and we must address the extending unemployment insurance, raising minimum wage, enacting criminal justice reform, and securing voting rights for communities of color. Voting rights for communities of color, they can vote. All they have to do is have identification so that we can truly find solutions to these critical issues. Those people don't vote, most of them. They don't care. They did get excited about Obama. That got them excited for a while, but normally they don't vote that well. Neither the Mexicans even vote less. So why are you Republicans turning your back on white people that could put you over the top but are not going to step out of their house and not going to go to the polls for you sons of bitches? Now, there's 9 things that on the job you should never say to a woman because that could get you fired. 1, terms of endearment such as sweetie, hun, or cutie. This is when a term of endearment becomes anything but endearing in the workplace, such as language can be interpreted as degrading or belittling. 2, you've lost weight or you look so much better. Women as well as men may enjoy compliments on their looks, but saying this to a female coworker or an executive in an inappropriate time can make female coworkers feel as though their skills and their work are not taken seriously, that male counterparts are focusing on their looks. That's what men were put on the earth for, idiot. Comments on weight and other physical appearance should not be made to anyone in a business setting, as they imply a level of personal familiarity. They also suggest that the person was fat or looked bad before the person might have an undisclosed illness, which would obviously make the comment even more rude. Well, my favorite way of doing it is if I come upon something I don't like, I just go, bleh, as I walk by without saying anything. any kind of sexual comment. Not only do sexual innuendos, and derogatory terms like honey make the female employees on the receiving end feel embarrassed and offended, they also create a problem for the rest of the workplace environment. Think your top woman employees will stick around if they know a company does not promote and enforce equal respect? 4. Is it that time of the month, or is she so emotional? There's a preconceived notion that women cannot handle stress and tend to get too personal, invested in their work. Dr. Ella Bell, Associate Professor of Business Administration at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, speaks very passionately about her work. As such, she immediately took offense when a senior male colleague said to her, "You sure wear your heart on your sleeve." That ticked me off because I always try to be concrete. I interpreted my work wasn't making intellectual sense. Well, it probably wasn't. I did pull him over on the side afterwards and explain how it made me feel, and it was inappropriate. Bell notes, however, she was hesitant in speaking up at first as she did not want to draw more negative attention. Well, that goes on and on. Let's see what else we got here. 5. You aren't as aggressive with your subordinates as you should be. You need to be more forceful and tougher. These are code words for being more manly, says Barbara Frankel, Jewish senior vice president and executive editor of Diversity Incorporated. There are many different successful styles to manage people. What matters is results, and the manager's style is inclusive and in keeping with the corporate culture. 6. You only got the job because you're a woman. Suggesting to a woman that she's excelled in her career because the gender is disrespectful. But unfortunately, Bell says, this is a common occurrence. Especially, of course, the women in most cases are making less money, and that's why the corporates want them in there. So, the truth is a lie. 7. Do you really want that promotion? You'll never see your kids. You'll never be home at all. There still exists an unspoken belief that women executives will not be able to put in the same hours as men. People assume she won't be able to work more than 40 hours per week if she has a family. How can you have it both ways? One way, they're bitching because they're putting in too many hours, just like men do. And the other way is... oh... And then 8, you do that so well for a girl. That's my favorite. I love to bug my gal that way. You do pretty good for a girl. Even, and of course, then she throws something at me. Even jokingly, the phrase implies that women are inferior to men. Well, in many ways they are. And reinforces dated stereotypes. It also discourages many young women from actively pursuing interests in traditionally male-dominated industries, including STEM, technology, engineering, math fields. Well, I got a job for some of these women. Be a hod carrier. Any of you guys that are in the construction know what a hod carrier is, where you've got to climb a 20-30 foot ladder with a flat board on your shoulder with about 40-50 pounds of wet mortar on it and take it to the top. That's a good job for a lot of those dykaroos out there. 9. Are you pregnant or when are you due? You fat bitch. While your intentions here may just be based on goodwill and a little curiosity, this can be a sensitive question to ask any woman at work or outside the office. Assume it's none of your business unless the coworker decides to bring it up. Well, if I was management, I'd say, look, you weigh 300 pounds, you're going to have a heart attack right here in the office. You're going to collect on our insurance policy. So it has to do whether you're fat or whether the guys are fat too. So go to a fat farm and come back when you've done the right thing. Well, that's the nine things you never say to a woman. why would you want to work any place that they jump on you for all nine of those things, for saying things? I would never work at a place where there wasn't some latitude. In fact, I haven't worked for anybody else since 1964. No, 65 or 66. I quit working for the man in about that time and worked only for myself ever since. That's what you should do. Well, I see they've got some scams going to steal your hard drive. Let me tell you something. Most people's hard drives, it may be important to them, but in the big sphere of things, they're not important at all. Most people just have garbage on their hard drive. While this is certainly still around, many people have gotten wise to the fraud. Now some scammers are playing hardball. Enter ransomware. Ransomware is a form of malware that encrypts files on your hard drive with a highly complicated algorithm, then presents you with an ultimatum: pay up or you lose your files forever. The inherent brilliance of the software is this: while the software can be removed, the files remain encrypted. Paying the ransom is the only chance you have to see your files again. Some consumers are aware of the latest and most notable iteration of this trend known as CryptoLocker, which encrypts the user's data with a 2048-bit RSA algorithm. The scammers weren't fooling around when they invented this complicated algorithm, which is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to crack with a key, which will cost victims about $150 to $300. So there you go. I say keep your stuff in a file cabinet. The hell with it. Put it on a hard drive. I'm with Jimmy Carter. Send it in an envelope. Well, here we go. A cool man of the cloth. A suspended Roman Catholic priest who is accused of giving guns and explosives to a juvenile has been arrested on allegations he sexually assaulted a minor. East Windsor police arrested the Reverend Paul Gatta on Monday on 7 sexual assault charges, including 2 felony counts and 5 misdemeanor counts. Police say the assaults occurred over the span of about a year, beginning in January 2012. No other details of the allegations were released. There you go. That's your Jesus people for you. They have plenty of opportunity. Well, watch out, U.S. The Japanese are starting to build weapons again. Taking his nation's another step away from its post-war pacifism, the government of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe discarded a half-century ban on the export of weapons and military hardware on Tuesday. A move aimed at helping Japan assume a larger regional security role to offset China's growing military might. The decision, which had been under consideration for years before Mr. Abe took office, replaced the self-imposed ban dating back to the late 60s with new, still restrictive guidelines that permit the export of weapons only to allies and partners that agree not to sell them to third nations without Japanese approval. Yeah, right. The new guidelines will also make it easier for Japan to join multinational development projects for expensive new weapon systems, like the American-led effort to build the F-35 stealth fighter jet. Well, there you go, boys and girls. Another player in the worldwide weapons wonderland. Well, I guess I told you yesterday, they're getting ready to let Pollard out, this big spy, the Jew spy, the Israeli spy, and that's going to make Mr. Nitwit happy, or maybe not so happy, over there in Israel. Well, last April 19th, Glenn Beck told listeners that he had a big scoop for them, maybe one of the biggest scoops of his career. Glenn Pecker, what we do going forward from here will determine the fate of our nation, he said. Him and Alex Jones, it's always the end, emergency. Mr. Beck, the conservative talk show host, told an audience that Abdurrahman Ali Al-Harbi, a young Saudi national who was studying English in Massachusetts, was behind the dual explosions that ripped through a crowd at the Boston Marathon 4 days earlier. And the FBI was covering it all up, continued Beck on his radio program, The Blaze. Mr. Al-Harbi, whom federal officials had interviewed but cleared of all involvement in the Boston Marathon bombings, is now suing the radio pundit for defamation over numerous comments Beck made on the air last spring, casting Al-Harbi as the money behind the bombings, and alleging the government officials were protecting him. Beck repeatedly questioned the motives of federal officials in failing to pursue or detain Al-Harbi, as well as repeatedly falsely accusing Mr. Al-Harbi of being a criminal who had funded the attacks that took place at the Boston Marathon, reads the lawsuit, filed on March the 28th in U.S. District Court of Massachusetts. Oh, well, I wonder how much he's going to shake down old Glenn Pecker for. I'll bet you it'll be settled out of court. You wait and see. Which probably would mean that Glenn Pecker was lying. Well, here's an interesting story. After Christians distribute Bibles at elementary schools, atheists ask permission to do the same and get it. Last fall, the ACLU of Kentucky sent letters to superintendents in the state, warning them about how Gideon's International, the Bibles in your hotel people, were often given access to public elementary school children solely for the purpose of actively distributing copies of the New Testament Bibles directly to students. It didn't stop Casey County School District Superintendent Marion Souders from allowing the Gideons into the district's three elementary schools earlier this year. If you were a non-Christian group, how would you respond? Rather than filing a complaint, the tri-state freethinkers decided that they just wanted equal access. You let the Gideons give away materials to children, then we want to do the same. So with the help of the ACLU, they sent a letter to Souders requesting that books about humanism be left for students to pick up. It worked. Yesterday, elementary school students in the district had the option of picking up a copy of Helen Bennett's Humanism. What's that? A book for curious kids. There you go. Everybody's getting into the act. Well, I think this story comes from Washington State, I think. No, Richmond Times, Richmond, Virginia. Hopewell City Councilman Brenda Pelham is asking that a $2.35 million lawsuit filed against her by a former candidate for sheriff, whom she accused of being part of the Klan in a Facebook post, be dismissed. Pelham, who is a Negress, also asked in court papers that the racially charged case be moved to Hopewell from Colonial Heights, where the lawsuit was filed, because Catherine Mitchell, who filed the suit, is looking for an unfair advantage. Mitchell, who ran for Hopewell Sheriff and lost last year, filed the suit last month in Colonial Heights Circuit Court, alleging that Pelham maliciously sought to and did injure her. Well, that's interesting. The Facebook post, which will still be on Pelham's page, Tuesday afternoon alleges that Mitchell and Hopewell Commonwealth Attorney Rick Newman, who was running for re-election, helped oust former police chief Stephen Martin, a Negro. Pelham claims that Mitchell filed the suit in Colonial Heights because she believes she will be more favorable and sympathetic jury because her allegations of defamation involve race. Well, it sounds to me like everybody in this catfight is black. To boost her argument, Pelham includes demographics in her filing showing that 119% of Colonial Heights residents are black compared with 38.8% of Hopewell's population. How can you be 100? Oh, I see. That's 11.9%. I was wondering how you could be 100.9%. Anyhow, finally, a white person is standing up and fighting back and going after a black one for defamation. Well, the Anti-Defamation League says that Jewish hate crimes in Florida are on the decrease. Yeah, a raw ham tossed at the front of a Jewish community center in Tavernier. KKK painted on a woman's prayer center in Miami Beach. Pro-Nazi leaflets. Oh, my God, that's really bad shit. Yeah, somebody threw a raw ham at the front of the Jewish community center. It's a waste of a good ham. What the hell's the matter with you people down there in Florida? Better off to throw a Palestinian through their window. Boy, the famous bit incompetent have been at work here in Indiana. Boy, they had a real big case here. Waldron, Indiana. I have no idea where that's at. FBI agents have surrounded a home in rural central Indiana to confiscate what the agency is calling artifacts. A spokeswoman from the FBI in Indianapolis wouldn't identify the artifacts being recovered on Wednesday, but she said there was no immediate threat to the public. Well, then what are they there for? According to CBS affiliate, the officials said the man has a large collection of historical artifacts, including items from World War II. Ooh. He got to be a criminal. Other details weren't immediately released about the investigation in Rush County. Oh, it's about 35 miles southeast of Indianapolis. Television helicopter video showed the mobile FBI command vehicle, a moving van, and several tents alongside a two-story home near the town of Waldron. A man who answered the phone at the home being searched by the FBI, who identified himself as Don Miller, told CBS News that he was a lifetime collector who had a museum of hundreds of artifacts in his basement. He's obviously an Al-Qaeda front. He said he absolutely has rightful ownership of the artifacts and that he was cooperating with the FBI search. I've been in 200 countries collecting artifacts, he said. The FBI has scheduled a news conference about the investigation for Wednesday afternoon. Well, we'll see what happens there. Boy, that's really, the FBI is really at work protecting you and me. Boy, isn't that great? We might get hit over the head with a World War II pot that they put on their head, or maybe a canteen. No wonder they need 1,000 more FBI agents if they're going to be making arrests like this. Shows the aerial view of the house.
Going over the finer points of the darkest days of the George W. Bush administration. Some of it was even worse than Rumsfeld knew.
What about all these so-called torture memos?
Well, there were what? One or two or three? I don't know the number, but there were not all of these so-called memos. They were mischaracterized as torture memos, and they came not out of the Bush administration per se. They came out of the U.S. Department of Justice. Blessed by the Attorney General, the senior legal official of the United States of America, having been nominated by a president and confirmed by the United States Senate overwhelmingly. Little different cast I just put on it than the one you get. I'll chalk that one up.
Was the reaction unfair?
I've never read them.
Really?
No. I'm not a lawyer. What would I know?
The use of torture during the Bush administration is another dark stain in American history. I'm a very proud American. I believe in my country. And I believe that we stand for something. We should stand for something. There's a very famous address given by John Quincy Adams in 1820, addressed to Congress, where he said, America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Hopefully, we do not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy on false pretenses.
He told you that he wrote not one but two letters of resignation after the Abu Ghraib scandal involving American soldiers who photographed themselves abusing prisoners. Was that news?
It was known at the time that he had tendered his resignation. Whether he knew that Bush would not accept that resignation, I don't know. It's such a strange story. It's just a story about a man who is forthright and direct, often he is. But it's hard for me not to see some kind of cynical manipulation going on in one form or another. I think all told, this is a very sad and unfortunate episode in our history. I know something else. None of the officials of the Bush administration will ever be held accountable for what they've done. What they've done with impunity. The question, a lingering question, is it best for our democracy that we just sweep the past under the rug? Or is it better for us to confront it? I've just written a four-part series of articles on the philosophy of Donald Rumsfeld for the New York Times. It's interesting to read the comments. There's been hundreds and hundreds of comments pouring in. Some people say that we should forget about it. Other people say that he's a war criminal and should be tried. Others wonder why I'm devoting so much attention to the phrases and epithets of Donald Rumsfeld. Aren't they all nonsense talk and should be treated as such? I respectfully disagree. To me, his nonsense talk, for better or for worse, is deeply revealing about the character of his thinking and the character of the man. The bigger question, the more troublesome question in all of this, is why did we buy into it?
Do you think Rumsfeld is a war criminal?
Yes.
There's only one moment in the film when he becomes emotional.
We went to Bethesda and Walter Reed a great many times. The strength that you felt from the families and the people wounded was just absolutely an inspiration. Was an intensive care unit. The doctor said, this guy's not going to make it. We walked in, met the man, talked to him, talked to the family. I don't know what the word is, but the family, the wife said, I know he'll make it. Probably 2, 3, 4 weeks later, I went back, and sure as heck, the doctor said he made it. Unbelievable.
We had terrible arguments in the editing room about the inclusion of that scene.
So we're a very fortunate
My editor hated it. Used to call it probably still does call it Old Man Crying. What do you want to put that in the movie for? Doesn't it make Donald Rumsfeld look sympathetic, too sympathetic? I felt it had to go into the movie. I never saw this as a hatchet job. I still don't. I saw this as an attempt to reveal something. The crying is so much par for the course. He's talking about one soldier who is dying, who miraculously recovered. And so the story becomes a story of rebirth, triumph over death, almost, if you like, a resurrection. What is so fascinating about it is lost in that story are the hundreds of thousands of people who actually did die, where there is no coming back to life. All there is really is death. And it's something that I do not think should be forgotten.
The last question you ask him is, why are you doing this? Why are you talking to me? And he doesn't have an answer for you. He just says it's a vicious question. What's your guess as to why he was talking to you?
Well, this is so characteristic of Donald Rumsfeld. He has an answer which is an answer and is yet not an answer. I felt I had to ask him this question because everybody asks me this question as if I should have some definitive answer. I should be able to lay my cards directly out on the table. Why did you do this? Why did he do this? It's mostly, why did he do this? Why did he ever agree to be interviewed this extensively by you? What was he thinking? So I ask him the question at the very end of the movie. I say, sir, why are you talking to me? And he says, that's a vicious question. Pauses for a moment and then says, I'll be darned if I know. Why did we go to Iraq? I'll be darned if I know. Why do we torture people? I'll be darned if I know. Why did we scuttle the Geneva Conventions? I'll be darned if I know.
Well, surely he had seen Fog of War. You sent him a copy.
It's never been clear to me whether he saw a Fog of War. Although, when we first met, he said he hated it. He didn't say he'd seen it. He said he hated it. And he said to me, that man, namely Robert S. McNamara, had absolutely nothing to apologize for.
Can you compare the two and the experience of talking to each?
One man, deeply reflective, tortured by history, by his past. A man agonizing in many ways about what he had done versus a man totally unapologetic, totally convinced that everything he did was right. Would he do it again? I think yes. I think he would do it again.
How did this new film benefit from the earlier film, from lessons you learned making that film?
I learned with The Fog of War, maybe it's a lesson that I learned before The Fog of War, was to be patient, to not go into a set of interviews with a fixed set of expectations. Interviews, properly considered, should be investigative. And by investigative, I mean you should be in a position where you expect to learn something you don't know. If you know what someone's going to say in an interview, why bother doing the interview?
Yeah, it's the known knowns.
Sitting, waiting, puzzling through a wealth of material, hoping to figure something out without really knowing exactly what that might be. I often think that the job of a documentary filmmaker, and I suppose I'm some species of journalist, You want to capture something about the nature of the man you're talking to, something about his complexity, something about the complexity of the world around him, something that's real, not an attempt to answer to any specific agenda, but an attempt to capture something that was a little less clear before you started.
The type of camera you use for your interviews is one you invented and was named by your wife the Interrotron, combining two important concepts, terror and interview. Could you explain how it works?
From the very beginning of my career as a filmmaker, my first film, Gates of Heaven, it was obvious that there's a problem with filmed interviews.
To help them figure out whether they were near land. It's like the old story of Noah from the movie that's now causing so much controversy.
The compass, which we take for granted, really before about 1,000 years ago, not in our toolkit, and then a great advance.
Absolutely. Although even from fairly early on, based on people's ability to do celestial navigation, they quickly realized that what the compass was telling them was north wasn't necessarily exactly north, and they began to figure out that the magnetic compass wasn't exactly reliable. And of course, in years to come, that would become more and more of a problem, especially when you start using ships made out of metal, and then everything becomes increasingly difficult.
The systematic exploration of the world by Europeans once they got going in the 1600s.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where mapping and consistency and new tools really become important.
Absolutely.
Describe the forces that converged there.
Well, yeah, you have obviously the military and the economic issues involved here. You're trying to conquer large areas, and you're also trying to trade over large areas. So precisely what you have to do is figure out how to navigate long distances, both over land and over water. And so you see really serious efforts to solve that problem on both fronts. I mean, one of the real breakthroughs comes in France, where you have the Cassini family that basically invents the first way to really accurately map an entire country using a method called triangulation. And France becomes basically the first country in the world that actually has its entire territory really accurately mapped. There's a story that I think it was Louis XIV was looking at the map as it was developed, and he shouted, "You guys have taken away a third of my country here."
I pictured it as bigger than that.
Exactly, because it turned out that when you use this triangulation method, you didn't have to walk over every inch of a countryside in order to map it properly. And they were able to figure out much more accurately what France's size and shape actually was. And when people saw the French doing it, and the Europeans saw that going on, they started applying the same technology more and more frequently to all the other surrounding countries, and little by little, Europe starts to be very accurately mapped, and of course, they're interested in doing the same sorts of stuff in other parts of the world, too. So you have these grand mapping expeditions over the next several hundred years. Probably the most remarkable that is often forgotten was this whole British campaign to map India, where they had these amazingly well-trained people who were actually native to India, who they brought in and they trained and they sent to the most incredibly remote places under conditions of unbelievable danger, and have them systematically recording all this mapping information to build a great map of India. It was an amazing accomplishment.
But even into the 20th century, there were still expanses, you know, described as unknown or unknowable.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not quite 20th is my favorite. My favorite has always been Africa because, of course, I'm the descendant of African slaves.
Mm.
And, you know, you see the slave trade, millions of Africans exported from Africa to the New World. And you figure, well, the people who did this must know a lot about what's going on inside Africa.
Yeah.
They didn't know a thing. They pulled up to the coast, basically, and had people bring them their slaves.
There was stuff in there. Who knew what?
Absolutely. It's not till like the late 19th century that you really start to get the interior of Africa actually mapped. It's just people didn't know what was there. Even the people who lived there, of course, they knew what was in their immediate area, but they didn't know the great area all around them. And that's one of the things that starts happening late. And you're right, it continues further and further on. Huge parts of the world weren't even mapped until well into the 20th century, or were not mapped very precisely.
But that century, the 20th century, just turbocharged this whole realm of mapping. And it, of course, is the flight path to where we are today. Describe
Absolutely.
The key breakthroughs in the 20th century that allowed us to think of the Earth, our planet, as a planet that we can essentially know every nook and cranny of.
Well, yeah, I think that the real turning points come as a result of two inventions that are invented at almost the same time, and that's the airplane, which is really going to raise one of the biggest problems in navigation, and then the technology that's going to go a long way towards solving that problem, which is radio. Because first you get the airplane, and people suddenly realizing, oh my goodness, we're up in the air, and the maps we've got are designed for being on the ground. We have no idea what we're looking at when we're looking at it from 1,000 feet
mm-hmm.
up, and all kinds of problems arise with that. Of course, the airplane's first really major, massive use is in World War I, and there are all kinds of problems involved in trying to navigate while people are shooting at you, and that suddenly becomes a very real issue. And then even after the war, as a commercial enterprise, you suddenly realize, especially with the planes of this day, which were relatively slow, they might fly at 100, 150 miles an hour, you suddenly realize, if we can't fly at night, and if we can't fly in cloudy weather, we might as well park these things.
And use the train.
And use the train, because a train runs, I mean, this is what happened when the U.S. Post Office decides they want to move the mail.
Mm-hmm.
They find out that if the planes have to land at night, they might as well just use trains.
So mapping requirements once you're in the air become much more demanding and sophisticated. Radio gives part of the answer.
Radio gives part of the answer, of course, because radio waves travel in straight lines, and they can be used as guidance for telling airplanes which way to go. They can also be used, and this is another thing that happens during the First World War, they can also be used to locate enemy troop concentrations when they start broadcasting on the radio, because you start having developments like the Bellini-Tosi technology that was developed by a couple of Italian engineers who figured out how you could use a radio locator to actually triangulate and find out exactly where a transmitter was. Suddenly, when your enemy is starting to transmit on radio, you can figure out exactly where he is.
Radio is a kind of airborne intelligence, and of course, the great extension of that goes into space with Sputnik, and suddenly it's satellites to GPS.
Absolutely. And that's where you're right. We start in on that. But I do want to mention also that there was another track that occurs around, well, actually, this starts in the 40s and gets really going into the 50s, where you have the rise of a technology, a lot of it was developed at MIT, called inertial navigation. Somebody said, what if we wanted to devise a way of navigating where we didn't have access to radio, where we couldn't rely on receiving, like if you're on a submarine under the water?
Mm-hmm.
Could it be possible to build basically a black box where you tell it where you are when you start, and then that box, no matter where you go, can detect the accelerations and the movements of your vehicle and use that to figure out where you are at any given moment? And it turns out that it could be done. Some of the best physicists in the world at the time said it couldn't be done, but it turned out it could be done, and that became inertial navigation, and that's what you use to guide, like, submarines under the ocean. Unfortunately, you also use it to guide nuclear-tipped ICBMs. So, inertial navigation is a mixed bag, but it's an amazing breakthrough.
Behind so much of the navigation, real or imagined, those missiles never flew in the Cold War style that people really feared. Nevertheless, there was a huge investment in that. Meanwhile, the satellite system grows and grows. All this builds the foundation for the turn that Hiawatha Bray describes in his new book, You Are Here. The turn from mapping the world to mapping ourselves, where we are now the terrain of interest, and we are amazingly, intimately tracked, navigated, mapped all the time. Hiawatha Bray, stand by. It's great to have you with us. Listeners, are you a map lover? Are you a navigation lover? What's the artifact from history that you most love in this? And what about now? Are you constantly beaming out your own location? 800.
Well, that's about it for today. Tomorrow I'm going to finish this up because it's interesting that with the information you're going to get on here, that you just can't hide if you're going to have any kind of electronic equipment around you like a cell phone, or just no way to stay off the map, except you'll hear about a guy over in Israel who's built a phone that reverses the situation where you can hide. So it's a pretty interesting thing, and I forget just exactly how long it took, how long this show went, but I'll play the rest of it tomorrow. You're going to find it very interesting, and you're not going to feel very safe, I'll tell you that. 14-5.
Arthur and Alice played shuffleboard down in Dunedin today. Then they packed the best picnic they could. in Ann Arbor and in L.A. They'll come to visit. Last winter they did. A Busch Gardens Disney World Day. But his heart's full of love.